Hey, what's up? It's Doug here from the My Hi-Fi podcast. You already know that. You're listening to it. I wanted to pop in before I send it to this episode. So when Carl left the show, after I shed a tear and I was extremely sad, as everyone knows, I was like, I want to keep doing this. And I want to make sure I'm producing content that y'all want to listen to. So I went to the Facebook group, which people could check out the Facebook group if you want to. It's just milehighfi.com/Facebook. And I was like, what do you guys want to hear? Like, people have questions in the Facebook group. Sometimes they're very specific. It's a safe space in there. People give great advice. And it's not too big. It's only like 700 some odd people currently. And people, you know, they liked some of the stuff that we were already producing, but they wanted to hear more case studies, people that were maybe in the quote boring middle in the sort of saving and accumulating phase and beyond, or people that just retired. So we get a nice blend overall. And someone reached out to me, Adam reached out to me, the guest of the show today, reached out and he was like, hey, I think I have a pretty cool story. I want to, you know, share it with you. And it turns out he lives roughly in the area. So he was going to be around. And I was like, hey, if you come to the studio, we could record. And I think there's more of a connection if you can interview someone like face to face. Some people disagree. In fact, over the weekend, somebody was telling me that they used to do everything face to face. And they decided that it wasn't worth it. And they started doing everything remote. And I was like, well, that's weird. I find I actually have a better connection with someone if I could hang out for a little while and then do the interview, but everyone's different. So anyway, the point is, this is one of the episodes of, it's going to be sort of a start of a series where I'll be chatting with people that are like in progress, or they've reached sort of like a coast fi or a slow fi situation, or whatever, just more case studies, more people that are like in the middle of it. And, you know, we're beyond the sort of the basics, the 101 ideas of like 4% rule and some of the other things. And we're just hearing what people are doing, how it's working out for them, and getting some tips and advice. So it's a great episode here with Adam. I also want to plug Mint Mobile. So partnered with them recently. And here's the thing. I was on a corporate plan. I'll go a little bit deeper here. So I was on a corporate plan from back in the day. My friends Matt and Joel that host the How to Money show, they have a little segment where it's like frugal or cheap. And this was a cheap thing. So I was laid off many years ago. This is all fiction, by the way, so no one come after me later. So I was on this corporate plan from before when I was laid off. Again, fiction. I'm just telling stories, y'all. And basically, I can't remember. It was like a 15 or 20% discount or so. And there's not a good mechanism to inform the cell phone company that you're no longer working with the company. So you may be on like whatever your Hertz plan from 15 years ago, or you might be on a cell phone plan from 8 years ago. So anyway, I was getting a discount and it was an okay deal. But I knew that Mint and other similar carriers like that, but Mint specifically, are such a great deal. So in the last year, I've saved $180 just from switching to Mint Mobile. Our service isn't any worse. Everything is fine. We've traveled. We've gone on road trips. There's plenty of nationwide coverage. In fact, I'm pretty sure Mint is on the T-Mobile network. So basically, you could switch over to Mint and you could go on an extra weekend trip or something like that. If you have a bigger family and more cell phone plans, then you'll save even more. So new customers are eligible for any plan at $15 per month for 3 months. So you pay in one block, it's like $45. Personally, I have the 5 gig per month plan. So does my wife. That's all the data that we need. So we pay annually and save a little bit more. So it's $180 per year for each of us. And I was paying about $1,440 previously. And if you want to help support the show, you can go to milehighfi.com/mint and check out Mint Mobile, see if it works for you. Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. Today we're going to talk about slo-fi a little bit and coast-fi, maybe the blend of the two, and lifestyle design a little bit. I'm going to chat with Adam, a psychology professor who has achieved remarkable financial success while prioritizing a 30-hour work week in a fulfilling lifestyle. This is pretty amazing. He went from zero net worth to about $1 million in about 10 years on modest salaries. So we're going to explore Adam's unique approach to slo-fi, strategic real estate investments across multiple states, how his background in psychology has shaped his financial decision-making, and get into probably some pretty good tangents, I think. So Adam, how's it going today?
It's great. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story.
And you were, you know, kind of passing through town, and I much prefer doing interviews in person. I think, like, we hung out for an hour and change beforehand, got some pizza and stuff, and it's much better than connecting on like Zoom or whatever, and it's a little sterile. So this is good. Thanks for coming in and making the trip out here. You sent me a lot of notes, and I have to be honest. Well, you're an academic, right?
Yeah.
You must type really fast because you wrote so much in those emails.
Yes.
It was amazing.
Yes. I'm a long emailer.
Yeah. And I was like, this is great. And I felt a little bad. You know what I'm talking about, right? So,
well, I get that feedback all the time. Yeah. So what you're saying is nothing new.
So it was totally fine. I replied back, you know, you would write a pretty decent email, and then I would reply back with like three sentences. And then, so it was not a lack of interest. It was just like, I don't type that fast, and I get a lot of emails. So, and I take it you probably think through many things through writing. Is that, am I correct?
Sure.
That?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have lots of notes. We're only going to be able to get through a portion of it. Mm-hmm. And one awesome thing that you wanted to talk about, and I was like, this parallels perfectly, is the story of the Mexican fisherman, which is a famous parable. But I'm going to turn it over to you to describe that, and then we'll dig into it a little bit.
Okay. So I first heard the story when I was a sophomore in college, maybe junior. You know, you're in college searching for the answer, and I was taking a class in human growth and development that covers the entire lifespan of how people change. And so one recommendation I make for people is it could be kind of boring and academically based, but if you read any sort of nonfiction book on how humans change and evolve as they get older, it could be really helpful for people to understand, to anticipate those changes and be ready for them and embrace them and maximize them. So I'm taking human growth and development, and the teacher was telling the story of the Mexican fisherman. I really don't want to recite the whole thing. You can Google it online. But basically, an American businessman goes to this small Mexican fishing village, strikes up a conversation with a guy that, you know, caught some pretty good fish and was like, hey, you know, how long did it take you to catch those fish? And he's like, a couple hours. And he's like, well, why don't you go out and catch more? And he's like, well, I have enough. You know, I sell some at the market, feed my family with part of it. I got to meet up some buddies, play some guitar, you know, later on, you know, drink some wine with my wife. You know, I'm pretty busy. You know, I don't really want to be out on the boat for that long because I have so many other more important things, you know, on shore. And the gist of it is the American businessman keeps on going through all these iterations, like, well, if you fished more, you could buy this and you could buy that. And then at the end, the result is, you know, well, what would I get at the end? And basically the American businessman was like, well, you could retire to a small fishing village. You could sleep in only, you know, hang out with your buddies, drink wine with your wife, play guitar and all that stuff. And so basically you don't really have to go through all that. You can just do what you're doing right now. And so when I was younger, I was a caddy, 13, 14, 15 years old, and I was around kind of wealthy business people, and I would carry their bags. They weren't that happy. And so it was pretty unimpressive. I'm not saying they're bad people. It's just sometimes you would think, oh, when you have more money, just all your problems get solved. And that was kind of my experience. And then when the professor was talking about the Mexican fisherman, it was just a light bulb moment. I said, that's it. That's the answer. Because I had seen the American businessman in person. I carried his bag. And a lot of struggle, a lot of stress. So ultimately, you have to decide what's going to be best for you. Personality is mostly genetic. A lot of people don't know that. I don't know exactly where that myth came from, but embrace who you are. You know, lean into the things that you value. When you do that and you put all the energy into the things that you care about, it's just really hard to lose. Like you just always win.
So that story was in your mind from your college time frame, right?
Yep. Yeah. So that story was probably at about 22.
Okay. And you got the punchline right away. I don't think I ran across the story until maybe like 10 years in the corporate world. And by that, like by then I was like, oh, like I do get that. And I was looking at whatever the people in the corner office 10 years ahead of me. And I'm like, well, I know I don't want to do that. So I started shifting a lot of gears then. Okay, cool. So that was on your radar. And when did you hear about FI or FIRE? When did you get exposed to the FIRE community?
Just quick preface, but yeah, probably 2000. It was the Mr. Money Mustache Washington Post article is when I first heard about it.
Okay.
And I was pretty frugal in graduate school just because I had to be. And even though I didn't make that much money, it was still a pretty like robust experience hanging out with other people with similar interests, you know, deep dive on stuff that you find interesting. And when you're hanging around with other people that are like in the same situation, it just all feels normal. Mm-hmm. You kind of forget that you have way less money than everybody else. If I was to go through that experience completely by myself, I don't think it would be as fun. But like when you share that experience with other people, it was fun. A lot of work, but it was fun. Then I got a job, and then I just kind of felt like I didn't really find my tribe because just, you know, searching for something that, I don't know, didn't quite line up with the corporate world and all that. And then the Mr. Money Mustache article came out, and I kind of always lived frugally, but it was actually somebody with a voice saying, like, what you're doing is actually the way. Corporate America, fancy cars, fancy houses, like, you don't have to do that if you don't want to, because, like, that just never felt like me, you know? And I'm like, why would I spend all this time and energy to buy something I just don't really care about? And then basically reading that article, he was just like, I don't know, some sort of line, you know, just don't buy it. Just don't buy stuff. And that was like light bulb moment for me. Like, holy crap. Like, that's it. And so, yeah, through life, you'll have like, I don't know, four or five light bulb moments that kind of puts you on that path that is true to you. Cause it was like, that's how I feel. And I just kind of felt like I got permission to like live the life that I wanted to live. Whereas, cause like when you try to do it the other ways, you're going to get resistance, right? Why don't you have a fancy car? Why don't you have the enormous house? How come you don't do this? And you know, I'm like, hey, you have to come up with excuses for doing the things that you do. And then it's like, okay, this is it. This is my tribe. You know, these are kind of like my values. But I've never had anybody like voice it to me before. And that was the moment where I was like, holy crap, this actually exists somewhere else. Mm-hmm.
So I quickly looked up that Washington Post article that came out in 2013. So is that about right? You found it in 2013?
Yeah, I was teaching in Florida. I remember my wife was working at a corporation that rhymes with Bordstrom and fancy clothes. She was pretty level-headed about the whole thing, but her circle was, you know, very fancy clothes, expensive bags and all that. And then she would get me a $150 pair of jeans and she'd get it on sale for $90. You know, check out these jeans. I'm like, that's cool. Like I do appreciate it and they look awesome, but you know, I don't think they're really that much different than my $15 Costco khakis. And when I read that Mr. Money Mustache article, that was like permission to buy the $15 Costco khakis, keep on doing that. Because if you continue to do that, you're going to end up buying your freedom. And that's what I was kind of interested in doing.
All right. So your wife was generally on board.
She's been phenomenal. She was kind of in that circle. I don't think it ever really felt quite right to her, but you, as a social psychologist, you end up doing what other people do around you. And so it was very high fashion, very expensive. And she went to school for that. She went to Colorado State, Fort Collins. That was her major. So she was in it from, you know, that was kind of her thing. It wasn't like she enjoyed the process of, you know, making people look good, making people feel good about themselves. It wasn't like a status thing for her, but that status thing does exist in that circle. And I would say over the years, I never really tried to force it on her, but I was like, hey, you know, why don't we do this? If we do it this way, then it might give us some more opportunity. And I think what kind of happened was, is as she kind of saw her life changing and we just had more and more choice, more flexibility, more room to do more things, she's like, okay, I get it. Like, this is working. So I, you know, like it was, it's an easier sell if you can see progress from it. It's a much more difficult sell if you just like force somebody like, oh, we need to do this. And so I kind of took the slow approach. Hey, let's consider doing this. Let's consider doing that. And then it just kind of evolved into a more flexible lifestyle that she really does enjoy now.
So in 2013, you found the blog. Mm-hmm. Did you have your sights set on like a specific date to retire? We were just talking to Carl, Mr. 1500 days, yeah, right? So he was sprinting as quickly as possible to retire. We're obviously talking about SloFi. So yeah, what did you think at first? And when did you arrive at like, hey, we could actually just kind of shape things a little bit differently and we don't have to be in a rush?
For me, I didn't really hate my job. I enjoy it, teaching college. I think I score high on high need for cognition. So if I ever did quit my job, I would need something else to fill that hole because I would feel it. Because I go to work, I get to hang out with an economist. We chat about macroeconomics. Then I go down the hall and I talk to a history professor. We talk about history. Then I got a lawyer down the hall. We talk about law. And like that just feeds my brain, and that's kind of what I need. And so, however, my employer might say, hey, you want to teach an overload? And the answer is no. So like an extra class, like I absolutely love my job, but I don't want to do it so much that I hate it. So the idea of FI just provides a lot more flexibility to enjoy my job, where you can kind of say no to the things that you don't like. And then the big thing, which is actually part of the original plan, more money for travel. Travel is really important to me. Part of the reason why I wanted to go into education. So I get 3 months off for the summer, month off for the winter. Making those decisions will then give you more income for the unique experiences. So I really like to have unique experiences, and you know, money helps achieve those goals.
We have a little story about how you got offered a job for considerably more money, but you took a lower paying job. Can you talk about that decision-making process?
So coming out of graduate school, it was November 2010. I was supposed to be done in the spring. And I was mostly applying to academic jobs, but the economy wasn't doing great. Academic jobs are competitive. So I applied to a few non-academic jobs like research positions. And so I applied for this job in Washington, D.C. It was a research position for public policy on energy efficiency. And so it's kind of a cool job. They're really close to where all the politicians hang out. And then the researchers will actually get the opportunity to testify in front of Congress that can then impact public policy, you know, for environmental regulation or policy. And so, but in DC, it's a weird microeconomy. Even though there was kind of a big recession happening in the rest of the United States, there was no recession watching DC. And so I interviewed with a few people. I was like, hey, the houses here are still pretty expensive. You know, there's no discount, even though the entire rest of the country is heavily discounted. And he said, yeah, our city's biggest employer, you know, the United States government, will continue to hire even if we're in a recession. Like, it doesn't matter. So you really don't get those dips, you know, with the real estate market. So they loved me. They offered me the position for about $67,000. But the cost of living in DC is crazy high. And I was kind of doing the math. If I took this job, what would my quality of life be? We looked at apartments. A basement level apartment at that time, like a one bedroom, was like $1,900. You're in the basement with a little tiny window. If you actually wanted to see sunlight, that was going to cost you $2,200. And I ran the numbers and I said, you know, thank you very much, but that's not anywhere close to what I would need. And they kind of were like, well, you can commute in, you can take the train in, be about an hour. And I'm like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. What is that going to do to my quality of life? You know, shh. And then I said, you know, I really appreciate the time. I was like, I'll do 67 from Denver if you let me, you know, work remotely. And they're like, well, it's not really a remote position. And I said, I know it's not, but like, I think 67 is a reasonable offer for like 98% of the rest of the country. But for DC, it's just not reasonable. And I just can't do that. And so they said, okay. And the important thing is like, don't burn bridges. Like, that's what they could offer. I, you know, thank them for their time. I was a little upset that I had to fly out there to get that offer, but whatever, it is what it is. And then it totally worked out, and I've taken a job in Florida for $40,000. I was making 40 plus I'd take a teach a summer class, make like 45. They called me, a headhunter called me, and they're like, hey, you know, we've been having difficulty filling this position for like the last 4 years. I'm like, yeah, because it doesn't pay enough. And she says, well, they rebudgeted the position. And she's like going over the numbers. And she's like, you could probably, you know, you were their first choice. So I'm calling you first. I'm trying to get you to interview for it again. You could probably get 125 if you negotiate it up. I was like, okay. So now I'm making 45 and I'm doing the math in my head. And I was like, I appreciate the offer. Thank you so much for calling. But I got my academic job 3 months off during the summer, you know, month off during the winter. I was teaching the classes I wanted to teach. I bought a house for 95 grand. My mortgage, my PITI was 625.
Wow.
I was living close to my family. My dad retired there, fishing with him on the weekends, Mexican fisherman.
Damn.
Yeah. So I was like, yeah, I'm making 45. And somebody called me and offered me 125. And I just told him no. You know, and I was like, was that a smart thing? I don't know. Yeah. I think it is, but we'll see.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, you are considering like all these other factors. And like, I mean, it's still expensive to live in like the DC area, mm-hmm. like for hundreds of miles around, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Damn. Did you get any pushback from family or friends who were like, dude, that is crazy?
I think it was partly because the economy just wasn't good and people were scared. And so when you tell someone, somebody offered you like a very reasonable thing and you told them no, they're just like, really? I think in a normal economy, people would be more okay with it, but it was a scary time. But I'm a big proponent of education, and what tends to happen when you do have higher levels of education, you do get more choice. It doesn't always mean you make more money. Like it kind of does, but like it's not guaranteed you make more money. But really, my pitch for a 4-year degree is you're just going to have more opportunity to say no. It's not that you're going to make like exponentially more than your friends that didn't have the 4-year degree. You will make more, but you're going to have the opportunity to say no and pick and choose and then actually live the life that you want to live.
Okay. So we're going to get around to SloFi in a second. And I want to take a detour just on your net worth. Cause like mm-hmm. one of the things in your pitch here was like,
yeah.
You had a net worth of zero, basically, mm-hmm. and then 10 years later, about $1 million, which mm-hmm. is, I like the round numbers.
I like the round numbers too, yeah.
It's a good headline.
Yeah.
So when did you start tracking? Can you talk about the progress? And you could be as detailed as you want to be.
Sure.
On like, hey, there's real estate piece, like we were making X amount. Mm-hmm. You don't have to tell every year, but if you sure. had some like milestones along the way,
yeah.
just so we hear about the progress.
Yeah, for sure. So I'd like to preface, you've probably heard this before, but humans think in linear terms, straight lines. So when we think about progress and growth, we think it's going to be this like straight line, but that's not really how it works. It's very slow to get started. And then if you're doing the things that are gaining momentum, you know, you get that exponential growth. And so basically my wife, I leave graduate school. I didn't have my PhD yet. I was ABD. That means you have everything done except your dissertation. So I'm teaching in Florida. I get my first academic job. My wife's making like 35 and I'm making like 45 with a summer class. So what's that? 80 grand.
Yeah.
And then so we're at zero. I actually had a rental that I bought in graduate school, but the equity in the rental kind of matched my student loans. So I was about at maybe like plus 25 net worth. Mm-hmm. And then my wife was like negative 25. And then together we're like right at zero when we started. So like perfect, you know, great number, you know, nice and round. So then when I was thinking about, you know, growing my net worth and being the Mexican fisherman and just having options, I just spent a little bit less attention to the actual number on the paycheck. And I was like, okay, what's like the best holistic spot for me to be in? And so I ended up getting a job at Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida in 2011. There was a housing recession that happened around that time. Florida took it on the chin. And so I'm like, this is my chance. My dad also recently bought a vacation home / retirement home there. I could live with my dad for 6 months for free. That would be enough time to save up for a down payment. So I bought a house for $95,000, 4% down. You know, the mortgage was originally around $685, but then once I got the discount for being a Florida resident, it went down to like $625. And so even though we were only making $80, you know, with it, when you have a mortgage payment of $625, no state income tax in Florida. My health insurance was $50 a month. I was getting an 8.5% contribution to my 401k. Just so many little things. But the thing is when you tell people you went to graduate school forever and you're making 40 grand, you're going to get pushback. And I wrote this down for my master's advisor. I called him like, hey, I got a job. I went to, I did a master's program in California, Cal State San Marcos. I'm like, hey, I got a job. And he's like, cool. And I was like, yeah, 40,000. Ouch. That's what he said. And he's a great guy, but like, it's a little bit of an ego thing. And I think that's what people are afraid of. Like, and, but that $40,000 job was like the best spot for me. It's just, you have to get over that number because all the little things around it just made so much sense.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so that house that I bought for $95,000, now it's worth, I still have it as a rental. It's worth $365. The mortgage is a little bit higher now because we did a cash out refi to buy our current house in Colorado, but it still cash flows $1,000 a month. It rents for $26,000. The mortgage is $1,600.
Damn.
And we, that's great. And the original investment was $5,000 because I was putting 5% down on a $95,000 house. And so that's kind of, so I think with real estate, when you have, you don't have as many means, you don't have the big corporate paycheck. If you could make strategic real estate moves, that's kind of the, I think the really the lever that you can pull, you know, when you don't have the big corporate salary. If you have the big corporate salary, I think real estate's probably not as attractive because you have so many other options that require less work. But when you don't make a ton of money and you just have a little bit of extra time, if you can kind of play this real estate game, then you can get those returns to then get you the freedom that you're seeking.
That's a great way to put it. I don't have a lot of interest in real estate, and we'll come back to that a little bit. But you bought at mm-hmm. the bottom of the market. Mm-hmm. And when I bought, it was like 5 years before at mm-hmm. the top of the market. So it's just like, I set myself up for failing, and you have options when you purchase.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Makes total sense. And I generally had high paying jobs. So I'm like, I could do other stuff instead. And I don't like real estate. So it makes sense.
Not for sure. And I, you know what, that's great. Cause like, you know what you like and you know what you don't like. And that's the whole thing. Like, create a life where you're doing the things that you want to do. And for me, I grew up in a kind of a blue collar family. My dad was a pipe fitter. My cousins are roofers, electricians. A lot of my summer jobs were, they would get busy and I'd help out. So just by default, I kind of knew just some of the basics, and it just wasn't as scary to me to buy that foreclosure that needed a little bit of, cause I would get paid as a kid to, you know, solder some copper pipe and, you know, rip off a roof and pound some nails. And I wasn't an expert by any means, but I had enough experience to realize it like wasn't rocket science. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. And I, one last thing that I would say about the Florida house was, again, going back to that time of year, at the bottom, you know, as humans, we're social creatures. We feel more comfortable when like everyone's doing something, but when everyone does the same thing, it makes the price go up. So in order to really get the best deals in life, you are going to have to make a decision where the majority of people are telling you not to do that thing. And because everyone's telling you not to do it, that's going to give you the spread to make your biggest gains. So when I did say, hey, I took a job in Florida, going to make 40 grand, I'm going to buy a house. People are like, what are you doing? like you went to school forever and you're like making all the wrong choices. But I was like, no, this is the right choice. But because it was so opposite of what everybody else was doing, it felt wrong. But really it was right. And because it was so wrong to everybody else, it gave you that huge spread to like really make a killing. And then the last piece of it is in Florida, there's a lot of HOA communities where there's a gate and then the HOA mows the lawn. So when everything tanked in Florida price-wise, the HOA community still looked okay. They a lot of vacant houses, but the HOA still had enough money to mow the lawns. So I bought in a non-HOA community. So there wasn't an HOA to mow the lawn. So a lot of these lawns, you know, Florida in the summertime, the grass was like really high. And we drive around the neighborhood, and it just like did not look good. Like, cause like everything's overgrown and it's vacant. And like, when I looked at the historical data of the neighborhood, it had a very central location. It was very close to the university. And traditionally that neighborhood, it was about 5 to 10% above the median. And so, but at that current state, it was selling for about 5 to 10% below the median because it just looks so bad. And so I said, okay, this is not going to last forever. Buy the house here. As the entire city recovers, as the entire region recovers, this is going to have more opportunity because it should go back to where it was originally because the location is so central and it's close to the university. When the whole region recovers, this neighborhood will recover more because it's going to go from being below 5-10% to above 5-10%. And that's exactly what happened. It took about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. And then when things kind of stabilized, zoop, you know, went back up to where it was before. And honestly, out of all of those decisions I've made, that's probably the one that I have the most pride in, not because it necessarily made the most money, but I probably had the most active resistance against that one. Because if you drove around that neighborhood, like it didn't look good, but now it looks phenomenal. The area has grown, great location. It really rebounded very, very well.
Nice. Okay. So around 2010 or 11, you were making about 80K as a household. You got the good deal on the house.
Yep.
What are some other milestones along the way for your net worth growth?
My wife started to hate her job. I know that's not really a milestone. Well, it is kind of like it's a psychological milestone. And she kind of came, she was good at her job. So they kept on giving her more money, but it really wasn't enough to justify the work. And she would just kind of come home defeated. And that was around the same time that I found Mr. Money Mustache in the blog post. So I said, all right, let's give ourselves some. She's like, okay, this is not sustainable. I can't do this forever. You know, it's just too much work. And I said, okay, so let's pivot. You're going to do this one more year. And then the plan was to move down to part-time. So she worked at a store where you could actually make pretty decent money part-time because they make like 9-10% commission. So if you're a good salesperson, so the plan was she was going to work a year. And then we were going to stay in Florida. And then she was going to just go from working 50 hours a week to working like 20. And she was just going to do 3 shifts a week. And then in Florida, they have like a big migration of snowbirds that come down. They love to spend money. And she was going to kind of do this thing where she was going to stack her hours around the busy time when it's easy to sell shoes and then not work as much during the slow time. So really try to maximize free time versus, and that was the plan. And so we stacked money for about a year of her working her full-time position, you know, to get more and more options. And then on a whim, I ended up seeing a job posting for Kauai Community College, and they were hiring a psychology instructor. And on a whim, I decided to apply for it. And the deal with my wife and I, she goes, don't even mention anything until you get an interview. So I was like, hey, I got an interview for Kauai Community College. And she's like, oh, that's cool. She's like, yeah, I was at the Maui once. It's what's Kauai like? I'm like, it's just like Maui, like pretty similar, but like Maui 20 years ago. Like Maui's a little bit more developed. So like Maui 20 years ago, that's what it's like. And I said, I'm not saying it'd be a forever job, but it'd be super fun to teach there for a few years, you know, build up my resume, and then who knows where we'll land. But if we're just like trying to still figure, we don't know exactly where we want to land yet. Didn't have any kids. We're willing to explore. So ultimately they offered me the job. So then I was like, hey, you remember like we saved all that money so we could be more flexible because we had like 30 grand in our checking. I said, they offered me the job. So instead of you working part-time, you want to just like quit your job and move to Hawaii? And she was just like, yes. Yes, I would like to do that. And I said, okay, I'll call the guy and tell him I'm taking it. And, you know, we're going to move to Kauai. That was a milestone, right? And it felt so good because we had done 1 year worth of work of saving to then give us the flexibility to then make that decision. If we were still continue paycheck to paycheck, I'm not sure I could have pulled the trigger with that much confidence.
Yeah. Man, that's amazing. And had you been to Kauai before?
I was there once.
Okay.
On vacation. And I just graduated college. My parents paid for it. It was like my parents and my stepdad, it was their 10-year anniversary. And then I was graduating from college. So they said, you know, why don't we do like a 10-year trip? Like I'd never been to Hawaii. They had been a few times. my mom was in sales. She actually been to Hawaii quite a few times because she hit her quota. That was like the most common trip that her work would pay for. So I just graduated college. You get all those questions. Hey, what are you going to do with your life? You know, and I was like, well, I think I want to teach college. I think I want to teach community college. So we land at the Lihue Airport. We get on the highway. We were driving to the hotel. And then there's Kauai Community College right there on the corner. My mom was like, you should, if you want to teach community college, you should teach there. And I said, I'm sure it's awesome, but that school is so small. There's probably one full-time person. And they're probably not giving up that job until they retire or they die. And sure enough, time goes by. I see the posting, and there was some dude that taught there for like 30 years. He just retired. They posted the job.
Wow.
And I got it. So it was actually kind of an interesting little sidebar on how the whole thing unfolded.
Damn.
Yeah.
Big cultural change to live out there. Any specific highlights or what was it like? Like whatever the first couple months or so when you were trying to figure everything out?
You know, there's pros and cons to living, you know, lots of different places, but the part that I really enjoyed the most was the pace. It was slow. And there's a lot of Americans that need that, and they might not realize that. And allowing yourself to go slow and take care of yourself, you know, was just a great experience. Cause I kind of feel like mainland corporate America, go, go, go. People sacrifice their health a lot. And it was just normal and acceptable to take your time. Mm-hmm. Like, whereas I feel like people kind of look at you weird if, you know, it takes you, you know, if you actually take your time to do whatever it is. But I would just say the pace of life was so good for my health, mental health and physical health. It was an incredibly rewarding experience.
Can you give an example? I like the idea of going slower. And when I do go back to, you know, a busier city, I was just in Atlanta recently and mm-hmm. people are rushing around town. And yeah, mm-hmm. I'm like, man, why is everybody in a hurry around here? Mm-hmm. So I totally get it, but I'd love to hear an example if you have one from the islands.
I don't think I have one story, but like on the islands, there's this concept of talking story. And basically, you have to leave 15 minutes before you go anywhere because you have to bank on the fact that you're going to run into somebody and they're going to want to chat it up. So going to Costco is a social experience because you're going to run into people. They're going to ask how you're doing and they mean it. Like, they're just like, what's going on? How's it going? Not like, how are you? Oh, you're good? Okay, good. You know, like the American, like, I'm going to say it, but I don't mean it. And so it was a very cool experience to, and it's a small island, so you do run into people a lot. And I would say the most unique experience with going slow was people really prioritize relationships and connecting with people. And taking their time and asking, how are you doing? And they really meant it. And, you know, as a social psychologist, we are social creatures. That's a huge component to being a human. And it's almost kind of like we get so busy, we put that on the bottom of the list. And they put that at the top of the list. And it's very noticeable. And they are willing to sacrifice lots of other things to make sure that that always stays at the top of the list. So if I'm late, yeah, I might get fired. Or whatever it is, probably not, but like they really do prioritize the relationships and connecting with people and, you know, and talking story. And that was probably one of the most noticeable, enjoyable things, you know, living there full time for about 4 years.
Yep. Gotcha. Okay, cool. Before we get to the SloFi stuff, we do mm-hmm. have a sponsor today and that is GhostBed. You know, part of, at least for me, part of like the slow, unrushed pace is napping sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I like to take naps only when I need it. You know, if I get a good night's sleep, I don't need a nap. Like last night, I slept great, so I don't need a nap today. But are you a napper?
On occasion.
Okay.
Yep.
So what techniques do you use when you nap? You just lay down or do you do any kind of ceremony or anything exciting?
No, not really. If I think I just listen to my body. So if I feel tired, I'll nap. If I don't feel tired, I won't nap. So,
okay.
Very scientific.
If you're sleepy, you sleep.
Yeah. All but right. I think like people are like, oh, I'm tired. I should just go to Starbucks, right? And fight it. Yeah. So if I feel tired, I will actually close my eyes.
it's quite a luxury. Mm-hmm. Although I was going to say I worked from home for many years. And I mean, if I was really tired, I would like take a, 10 or 15 minute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you may not even fall asleep and actually take a nap, but mm-hmm. like you close your eyes and you're not overstimulated with other activity or whatever. So
right.
yeah, yeah. I would say when I don't get a good night's sleep, those next days are so rough. And I can bank ahead because I just got back from a conference. And typically at conferences, like you're not getting as much sleep as you should. And I sleep terrible just because I'm like overstimulated from chatting with people. So I'll often try to get ahead on sleep before I go. So I have like a little bit of a surplus. So I just make sure I'm not going in with a deficit, okay. you know. But at conferences, I almost nap every single day because it's like bad sleep, usually some drinks. And then
mm-hmm.
I need a break after lunch. So I'll have a nice healthy lunch, take a little nap for, you know, like an hour or two, something yeah. like that. Yeah.
I would probably say if I'm being totally honest, you're probably, you hit a, probably the alcohol. Mm-hmm. So when I drink, not even excessively, but if I have a couple right before I go to bed, cause I'm hanging out with my friends or whatever, I'll still sleep like the same amount, but the quality of sleep won't be as good. So when the afternoon comes around, I can kind of feel it. Okay. I need a nap.
Yeah.
And so that's probably the biggest predictor of me napping.
Yeah. Yeah. Alcohol totally wrecks it. Have the, does, yeah. have the drinks earlier in the day.
Yeah. Honestly, that's kind of the earlier in the day, eat something. Like for me, it's not so much the amount. I mean, obviously that's part of it, but like later at night, like yeah. having a drink right before you get absolute worst thing for me for my sleep. So yeah. try to have it a little bit earlier and then maybe eat a snack before I go to bed. And then I usually do a lot better that way.
Yeah. And are you a hot sleeper, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you might need to check out the Ghost Bed Lux. Actually, all the Ghost Beds have some cooling technology in there. There's a mattress up there, so I could let you
okay.
lay down on it
and all right.
roll around or whatever you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, there's a cooling technology. I think there's some sort of a gel. I'm not a sleep scientist, but there's something in there. Keeps it a little cooler. And it actually does like sort of pull the heat. You feel the sheets and they're like warm where you're at and you just mm-hmm. move over a little bit and it's cooler. It's nice. Like that times 10.
All right.
All right. So we'll check that out. And Ghost Bed, they have 101 night at home sleep trial, a 20-year warranty, which I believe is about double the industry standard. And you can save 50% with the code MILEHIFI at checkout or go to ghostbed.com/MILEHIFI. So let's move into the slow fi sort of thought mm-hmm. area and lifestyle design. So you're working about 30 hours a week. Your wife is still working mm-hmm. part-time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've reached a really good, I guess, balance of working and staying stimulated,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of freedom. So can mm-hmm. you talk about how you arrived at that? And I mean, if you get to
sure.
go into detail about no. how the balance is as well.
So I would say moving to Hawaii is expensive, but, and also with my wife working part-time, but basically we had rental income from two rentals now, one from Fort Collins and one from Fort Myers. And to be totally honest, I don't know if my wife could work part-time and then we could still pay her bills. So the rental cash flow from those two rentals were very helpful in allowing my wife to work part-time. We could still do it, but she'd probably have to get a full-time job. But the thing was, is like living in Hawaii, if you're working full-time, then you don't really get to experience the of living there.
Right.
So it was kind of a deal I made with my wife. And I said, you know, so I like to snowboard, I like to surf. And so I have a lot of expensive cities on my list for places to live. And I just told her though, like, I am not moving to my favorite beach town if I have to work 80 hours a week, because you know, that's not, yeah. that's just not smart. So whatever we do, I can justify living in the area that is more expensive as long as we have time to take advantage of the things that it offers. And so I lived in Breckenridge for a winter. I lived in San Diego for 7 years going to college, and they're absolutely incredible places to live. But if you're working 80 hours a week to afford to live there, like what's the point? And so I feel like we were in a spot where we could live somewhere that we enjoy and then also take advantage of it. So yeah, we had the two rentals. And then we were in the market to try to buy a house there, which is tricky. And we don't make a lot of money. But that first rental that I bought in Fort Collins, all of a sudden Fort Collins is doing well. So I did a cash out refi on Fort Collins, $150,000, and that was basically the down payment for Kauai. And so we ended up finding a house for $603,000, and then it had an Ohana unit in the basement. And so it needed work, needed about $50,000 worth of work. And the cash flow from the basement unit makes the mortgage affordable. And then the two other rentals then allow us to work, you know, part-time. It was interesting buying that house. We searched for 18 months. We were competing against people that had a lot more money than us. Wow. And we bought in the part of the island in Kailua. At the time, the median house price was about $800,000. That was kind of out of our price range, so we were looking at other neighborhoods. But there was this one house that popped up. It was listed for $549,000, but it had water damage in the basement. And so the bank, it was a foreclosure, they listed it very, very low. And they listed it too low. And this is kind of where the psychology comes in. Humans anchor based off the list price. And so I told my wife, I said, hey, there's a really good chance we're going to get this house. At the risk of sounding arrogant, like that's what I said. But here's the strategy. It's listed way too low. There's going to be tons of offers. People are going to over offer on this, but I'm going to anchor off the comps, not off the list price. Cause the bank made a and the bank did it strategically. They wanted interest, but they just went way too low. Like the neighborhood is 800. You don't need to list it for 549. So I said, there's going to be tons of offers. People are going to offer, you know, 10 grand over, 15 grand over, 20 grand over. I know this is a thing now, but like this is 2018. This is like before over offering was cool. So I said, we're going to offer max, whatever we can. I was like actually willing to go like 625, but what we could only qualify for was 603. When you do the, because my wife's income, because it was part-time, it didn't count for the mortgage people. And then we're going to rent out the basement, but that doesn't count either. So they're basically just going off of my salary and our two rentals. And so based on that math, 603 was the absolute most we could offer. So we offered 603. I was feeling pretty good about it. They told us there were 9 offers, all over asking, and we were number 2. Now, normally they don't give you that feedback and they don't tell you where you fell or anything. But basically the reason they called me is they said there was one person that offered more. They beat you out, but would you want to be the backup offer? And I said, I was super pissed, like defeated, because like I had the perfect plan.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, I'll be the backup offer. But like a week later they called, they said, hey, the first offer fell through, you want it? And I was like, yes.
Awesome.
And so I told my wife and she's like, you know, thrilled. We did an inspection. So as is, it appraised for 615. You know, even though I offered 10% over at 603, just as is 615, closed on it, fixed it up. I actually did pay a handyman to do most of the work. I did about 25% of the work. He did about 75%. Took about 6 months to get most of it done. And then I had my real estate agent, hey, just in case, you know, something goes sideways, can you please just do a market analysis to let me know what it's worth, you know, just in case something happens. And she said, sure. And she said, if you list it for $799, it'll be gone in a week. And so basically got that house for $603, put $50 into it, and then it appraised for $800. And that's kind of what the neighborhood does. It was actually very affordable because we were renting the basement out for $1,600. Our total mortgage was like $2,650. So then we only had to come up with $1,050. Mm-hmm. We had to come up with $1,050 and... there was one, I forget what it was, but, mm-hmm. but yeah, so it was like affordable as long as, you know, the downstairs tenants are paying. It's a very affordable kind of arrangement because it was actually, I was just going to low interest rates and then property taxes. A lot of people don't realize this. So Hawaii is expensive, but it has like the lowest property taxes out of all the 50 states. So, and I come from an area in Illinois where the property taxes are like 3%. So our property taxes were like 0.25%.
Wow.
So that's like, I don't know. You could do, it's like 10X, straight up 10X, where I grew up in Illinois, percentage based on the house. So I was paying $1,500 a year on property taxes, and that house in Illinois, easily $15,000 a year.
Wow.
So, and then this was my last point. So then when I'm making those mortgage payments at $2,650, I think I had like $800 going towards principal. So you get like a huge okay, down, you know, every month. And like, you can actually see the progress. Whereas if you got the house in Illinois, you might have the equivalent mortgage of 26, but you're only seeing a little piece because just a huge part of it's going to property taxes. So again, don't just look at the mortgage. You got to like, look at the whole thing. So even though the mortgage was kind of steep at 26.50, you got people downstairs paying 1600, low interest rates, you got $800 going towards principal, and then the low property taxes. So like, the overall payment, you have a lot of it going towards principal pay down, and it's not just, you know, fluttering away. Mm-hmm.
So you have three rental properties?
Well, so yes, three, because it was Fort Collins, Fort Myers, and then the lower unit for Kauai.
Okay. You taught in each of those cities?
Yep. And okay, so Fort Collins is a college house. I mostly rent to college students. Fort Myers is a college house. I rent to college students. I teach college. Mm-hmm. So again, lifestyle design, I think there's a little bit of a stereotype, you know, oh, college rentals are absolute worst. Well, just invest in what you know. Like, I interact with college students on a daily basis. I feel like I have the knowledge and the skill set to interact with them and know what they think and know how they, and what kind of happens is when you buy a bigger house closer to campus, the college kids will pool their money and they actually pay a lot in rent. It's not expensive for them individually, but collectively. So it's kind of like a win-win. Mm-hmm. There is a certain dynamic that needs to be managed when you're talking to college students like that. But again, because I've taught college forever, I just feel like that's just part of my skill set. It's not that big of a deal. For somebody else, maybe it is. Maybe they don't understand it and they don't, maybe they have more bumps in the road.
So we'll shift. Actually, before we shift, anything else around like the SLOFI concept or the way you've set it up so you're not overwhelmed working, your wife has a good balance with work and
One thing. So going back to the Mr. Money Mustache post, he was really big on tracking your net worth, and I never really did it. I did make strategic moves like for long term, but I never really put it on a sheet of paper. And then after the Mr. Money Mustache article, I actually would put it to paper. So then a year would go by, we would work part time, you know, my wife would work part time, and then like our net worth would like go way up. And it was like, that was the feedback that kind of I needed to make sure that we were on the right path. So basically, we went from zero to, you know, a million in about 10 years. And I think year three is when I started tracking it. It was around 150. So the last seven, it went from like 150 to a million. And I would just make conservative estimates on the real estate, you know, a little bit of 401k. And then tracking it really helped because it's pretty awesome when like you go on vacation or you do these things and then you come back and you're like looking at the number and it like went up a lot. And you're like, okay, we're on the right path. And I show it to my wife and she's like, okay, you know, I'm on board. This is definitely working. And so tracking it was super helpful. And I didn't start doing that, you know, based on that 10-year thing. I actually didn't start doing it until year three.
Okay.
Probably because there was nothing there. That's probably why.
You didn't miss out on much. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And okay, the other area with real estate. So mm-hmm. you have three properties, mm-hmm. three different states. They're all far apart.
Yes.
What kind of challenges does that, I mean, that seems overwhelming to me. But
for sure.
You're used to it.
Yeah. So I think a couple things that kind of flies under the radar. I think it's a huge help if you've lived in the house, because you can fix everything that you know that needs to be fixed before you leave. Now, obviously, there's going to be some things that break unexpectedly. But when you live in a house for a year, like, oh, that kind of leaks, I should do that. That's kind of flapping around in a weird way, I fix that. Which I think is a totally complete, like a very different mindset than as an investor buying something like sight unseen and I'm going to hire a property manager and whatever. So it's like, you could just dial it in big time before you vacate. And so we really don't have that many maintenance requests because we lived in the house. I kind of feel like for the Fort Collins house so I've had it 17 years now. And I kind of feel like right around year 10. So all that upfront work, I think it worked very well to about 10 years. And then 10 years was then that was the timeline when then stuff started to break. I think it's very realistic to self-manage, but you need a good handyman. So good handyman, the way that the world works now, post like, you know, COVID, everything's like, you know, you pay electronically, you do Zoom. And I think managing remotely would be a lot more difficult like 20 years ago than it is today. And I don't think I predicted that. I just think that what ended up happening, because in reality, if it is too much of a pain in the ass, then I'll probably just sell it. But the juice is definitely worth the squeeze as far as managing it. And, you know, I've lived in the towns. I have connections. It's not like, hey, I've never been to Detroit, so I'm just going to like buy some rentals there and I don't know anybody. I think that's a completely different experience than living in a house, knowing the community, having resources there, and then deciding to move somewhere else. Would I like them closer together? Sure. That would be nice, but that's not the way life goes.
Yeah.
And the fact that one of them is in Hawaii is really far away, but Hawaii is also really awesome. So, yeah, yeah. So there's the, you know, the pro and the con, but I think I do okay with it. I would not recommend people like, oh, my area is too expensive, so I'm just going to go out of state and I'm just going to pick a random town on a map, because the numbers look good on a spreadsheet. And I really don't like the spreadsheet people, because it's just like not connected to reality at all. There are lots of intangibles with real estate where, like, you know, there's a reason why that number looks so good. And then when you actually go to that place, you're like, oh, okay, now I get it. So I'm very big on, you know, understanding the community, understanding the employment situation, and then coming to the conclusion, okay, let's rent this thing out. And then once you leave, you know, just keep a few connections, few handyman. Yeah, that's about it. So,
and it sounds like you kept it. I mean, you lived in the homes, you kept it fairly conservative. You weren't trying to grow. And I think you mentioned that Coach Carson, Chad Carson, yeah, was an influence. So shout out to Chad. Yes. He was recently on the show.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Can you talk about like how he influenced you?
I kind of feel like, so the way in which he influenced me, I kind of feel like I was doing the same thing that he was. Although he's a little bit like bigger, he's got more rentals, but he almost kind of has that Mr. Money mustache kind of thing where it kind of gave validation to the strategy. Because you can scale real estate, that's what everybody says the answer is, like 10x everything, you know? And I'm like, okay, if I do 10x everything, what is my life going to look like? And I'm like, I'm not convinced it's going to be better, because there's going to be a whole list of headaches that are going to come along with that. And with Coach Carson, I already did everything, but I was always fighting with people, like, because they're like, no, you're doing it wrong. You need more rentals. You need 100 units. You need this, you need that. And he kind of gave people permission, the mom and pop landlord, who I'm a big, you know, fan of. I think it's an important piece of the economy. He like gave those people permission. It's okay if you have five. Five is okay. Like, you don't have to go to 100. Like, you can reach financial independence. I think his numbers are like, you need like 10 houses like paid off. If you buy more expensive areas, I think you can do it on less than that. But yeah, it was super refreshing, because he finally was like, okay, now I have permission to actually do the things that I'm doing. It kind of tempered the voices of the 10X people, you know, but again, if that's your thing and that's what you really want to do, do it. If you're a 10X guy, do it. However, my problem is the 10X people were telling other people that are not 10X people to do that thing. And it's like, no, if you're not a 10X people, do not 10X.
Yeah.
But if you are a 10X, sure, go for it. Do your thing.
It'll be fun. It'll be clear if you like it or not.
Yeah.
And shout out to Chad again. He has a book, Small and Mighty Real Estate Investor, How to Reach Financial Freedom with Fewer Rental Properties. So pretty cool. All right. Very good. And I think we covered the lifestyle portion of like rentals pretty well, but I'll also mention, like, from my perspective, I don't like the real estate stuff specifically. If it's great for people that want to do it. And if if my house that I first got, if I was able to rent it out and get the same kind of, I don't know, I didn't get a good deal on it. You get a good deal on your house in Florida that you described. But anyway, the lifestyle doesn't make sense to me. Where I'm just lazier these days, and I don't want to hassle with it. Last follow up question on the rentals.
Yeah,
is it hard to get new tenants in because it is far apart? How do you manage getting folks in there?
So as far as tenant turnover, you need a good cleaner.
Okay,
and it's not, I don't really have short term rentals, but if you just want to make sure that everything's kosher, make sure that you have a good cleaner that makes everything look nice. And tenants nowadays, like if you're not there, they don't care. They just like, hey, I'll, you know, put the key underneath the mat. You know, for my cleaner in Florida, she has a key, you know, so she knows where the key is. She'll leave it there. So yeah, I think for tenant turnover, you don't actually have to be there. You just pay a cleaner. Mm-hmm. I'm usually at my rentals, you know, one or two times a year. I still have family that live in Florida. I'm there 3 times a year. Go to Kauai 3 times a year. I'm there. Fort Collins, I'm probably there 3 times a year. So I'm around. So I'll stop in, pop in. Hey, anything need to be fixed? Mm-hmm. You know, and then I'd like to be ahead of it. Hey, this thing's acting a little bit weird. Okay, fine. And if it's convenient for me to fix it, I'll do it. But if it's inconvenient at all, then I just have the handyman do it. And so I just kind of feel like it's different now. I think there's a lot of assumptions baked into running rentals. You know, somebody wrote a book in 1978 on how to do a rental real estate portfolio. And I'm sure it was a great book and it was really good advice, but it's not set in 1978 anymore. Like you can operate on different principles.
Yeah.
And the last thing that I'll say about the rental real estate for lifestyle for the Kauai house, due to zoning, it does not qualify as a short-term rental, which I'm totally cool with. So I have to do the leases at least 6 months. Now, I can stay there for short term. I just can't rent it out. And so what happens is we rent it furnished. And that was not my idea. That was my real estate agent. Pay your real estate agents good money. They're worth it. They have really good ideas because they've been doing that for a very long time. So get yourself a really good real estate agent and then listen to them and do what they say. So she's like, you know, we had basically made the decision to move back home to Colorado to be closer to my wife's family, but we wanted to keep the Hawaii house. She's like, rent it out furnished. You don't have to do anything. She goes, pack your bags and leave. Leave everything. People want furnished rentals here. Corporations will send people to Hawaii to do like 6 and 12 month contracts. What they realized is people will get homesick. The first year will be bliss, and then they get homesick and then they leave. So companies have learned we can move a family, we can move an employee to Hawaii for 6 months to 12 months, and they just love it, right? And they rotate their employees. So like now some are full-time, but there's a lot of employees that are in Hawaii, they're on a 6 to 12 month contract, and then eventually they're just gonna go back to where they're from. And so if you're a concrete guy in Iowa, who was one of my tenants, hey, you wanna go to Hawaii for a year? You know, we'll send you there. You'll have this experience, then you'll move back home. Like they'll do that. So we get a lot of people that are on some sort of fixed 6 to 12 month contract and they're looking for a place that's totally furnished, and then they'll pay extra for it for everything to be set. And then what happens is we do get kind of a bit of turnover, but we really like that because when we're in between tenants, we stay at the house. And so it's not legal for us to rent it out on a short-term basis, but we can stay at our own rental as owners when we're in between long-term tenants. So for the last 4 summers, we've probably averaged about 6 weeks at our rental in Kauai, you know, fully furnished. And then we just basically kind of just get it ready for the next tenant. And for that type of rental, out of the 11 tenants that we've had, both on the upstairs and downstairs, 10 of them have rented remotely. Like, they don't need to see it. They just rent it based on the photos.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be there to show it. Like you post the ad on Zillow and you do the phone call and you do all that stuff. But like they're in Florida. Like they don't need to see it. Like they're not going to fly to Hawaii to look at the rental.
Yeah.
Like they are looking for a place like right away. And not a lot of Kauai landlords do that. They're like more old school. No, I got to meet you. I got to look you face to face.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So we stay there when we're in between long-term tenants. And so then we have to forfeit our opportunity cost of the rent that we would get, but that's much cheaper than what it would cost if we were to actually rent a house. So like for our house, for the upstairs that rents for like $4,000, if we were to rent a similar house for a month, it would cost us like $12,000 to $15,000. Like we can't afford that.
Wow.
But we can stay at our own house when we're in between tenants. And so I would just say like, try to, you know, think differently to try to get the thing that you want, because you don't always have to do the direct path. Like there are other ways to like make it work, like look for the indirect path and, you know, be creative. And sometimes you can meet your needs and do the thing you want to do, even though it's like a slightly different way.
It's pretty cool. All right. we got to start wrapping up here. And you have, you listed some future goals. So we'll do like kind of quick hit. I'm going to prompt you and then we'll just kind of go through quickly. You had some recent healthy wins and you want to keep moving forward with that. So what's been going on?
So I think I put on a little bit of weight after COVID and then I was like 41, 42. And so I just wanted to get a little bit healthier. So I've been running for about 5-6 days a week for about 2 years now. Haven't quite lost the weight yet, but I used to be diagnosed with hyperthyroidism. So that's when you have an overactive thyroid. And so I was on medication to then slow it down. And then last April, the doctor's like, you're in remission. You don't have hyperthyroidism anymore. So now you can be off the medication. And I kind of feel like that's part of the reason why I wasn't able to lose the weight in the beginning, because I was still on a medication that would slow down my metabolism on purpose. So it's been since April and I still haven't quite lost the weight, but I think I lost about an inch off my waist. So when I look in the mirror, I do look different. Yeah. But I am really honestly concerned about the weight, so to speak, because I'm into board sports. So I like to snowboard, I like to surf, and I want to do that as an old age. So I want to make sure that I kind of abused my knees when I was a kid doing all the tricks and I want to preserve whatever strength I have my knees. So I really do want to lose the weight, not for vanity reasons, but for just like activity reasons. I do really want to slim down, even if that means losing a little bit of muscle, because I want to be able to do those activities that are kind of hard on your knees. So I think I'll get there. I've seen enough progress, but yeah. I'm no longer hyperthyroidism, so I don't have to take the medication anymore. That's awesome. I was taking it for about 15 years, and I was told many times by doctors that what they do is they kill part of the thyroid with radiation. Just, you know, this is never going to happen for you. You're not going to beat this. Just do the radiation, be done with it. And I was just, I'm an optimistic person. I'm like, well, there's always a chance. There's always a chance. Well, there was. After 15 years, it's gone. And then that's kind of correlated with high blood pressure. And I don't know if I had technically ever had high blood pressure, but it was always elevated. And the last couple of times the doctor, I basically had the lowest like blood pressure ratings I've ever had in my life. So I'm like very much in the normal range, whereas before it was always a little elevated. So very happy about that.
Roth conversions. So you started doing them this year in 2024.
So the plan, I haven't done them yet, but my plan is to do it before the end of the year. So I'm kind of like trying to piece my financial plan together for like the next 5 years. And I still fall into that 12% tax bracket. I get a lot of help from real estate. There's a lot of deductions. So again, like when I go to Florida, when I go to Hawaii, you know, I am doing work at the rentals. So a lot of that is getting written off. So I get to count a lot of those profits as write-offs because I'm there and doing the things. So, nice. So I'm still pretty healthy in that 12%. And so I have it. So before the end of the year, I've been reading more about it. So I kind of want to try to, my wife and I both have like these old IRAs. They were 401ks. We did the Roth,
just a rollover.
Rollover. So they're sitting in rollovers. So now every year kind of going forward, the plan is to like, you know, cash out like 20 or 30 grand, pay the 12% tax, and then have it go into a Roth. And then that will be, I'm really into the three buckets. I'm not an expert on it, still learning about it, but I listened to the Money Guy show. Shout out to them. They've been very helpful in the three bucket strategy.
Can you just describe it for people that don't know?
So basically, you're going to have pre-tax 401k, right? You got money going in there. And the biggest, what I've realized by help from the community is people kind of put too much money in there because yes, you get to avoid tax now, but like on the back end, especially if you're a FI person and that number balloons, you're going to be paying a lot of tax on the back end when you finally pull it out. So to be tax efficient, don't put too much into your 401k. Put it in these other areas. So the second one is Roth. We've been pretty close. The last 4 out of 5 years, we maxed out our Roth. The 1 year we didn't do it, we had to spend 18 grand on a roof for one of the rentals. Mm. So last 4 out of 5 years, we've been maxing out the Roth. And then the third bucket then is going to be the after-tax brokerage accounts, which I've recently learned are pretty awesome because if you stay within a certain level, you could actually pay 0% tax on that.
On the capital gains.
On the capital gains. On the capital gains, yeah.
It's like 85K. Consult your professionals. This is not advice. And yeah, that's awesome. Actually, in your next point here is the third bucket, the taxable brokerage account.
Yeah.
So you're going to get that going here pretty
soon. So I think, so we're in 2024 right now. So I'm going to start doing Roth conversions now. Then 2025 is get the get the after tax book going. It may happen. It might not. We gotta get buy my wife a car, but I'm thinking like late 2025, early 2026. That's probably when we'll finally get the Roth bucket. And so if I'm trying to strategize this for the next 5 years, I'm kind of hoping the next 5 years, cause you got to stay under that, like that 90,000 or whatever. So mathematically it should work out where we can convert, all the IRAs to Roth. We have that space. Then in 5 years, I'm hoping we have enough of the after tax built up so we could start selling some of that and harvest some of those gains at 0%. But we don't have anything right now, so we can't harvest anything because there's no after tax. But I'm thinking in five, so start it next year. Then in 5 years, once the Roth conversions kind of get depleted, then we just move to the next stage where then we start cashing out the after tax at the 0%. So that's kind of the plan.
Okay. And as a side note, you didn't ask, but what you're describing, probably one of those deals where it would make sense to hire an advisor for like 2 or 3 hours and like, here's what I'm thinking. And then
probably
it, like there's companies like Nectarine, which we're an affiliate, we'll link up to it, but you could hire someone for an hour or two and they don't have to do a full analysis. They might need to, but basically, since you're only going to do this once, right? You don't have any experience. You don't want to make a mistake on first time.
Yeah.
Of course, there's people in the community, like the folks we were having lunch with. You could probably ask like 3 or 4 people and they're like, okay, be careful on this. You're probably good. Just double check that one thing.
That's good advice for sure.
Sounds like a good plan. And for people that are wondering, with the three buckets, you may not get the highest returns as far as like tax savings and other things, but it kind of maximizes your flexibility. So my wife and I were 45 and 46. At some point, we accidentally, or not accidentally, we arrived at this bucket strategy, but without hearing about it, we're just like, well, we want to have access. We don't want to have to jump through too many hoops to get to our pre-tax retirement accounts when we're much younger. So we have, actually most of our net worth is in a brokerage account, or our various brokerage accounts. So anyway, it gives you options even though you don't get maximum tax savings.
All right. So flexibility is super important. I'm glad that you brought that up because I always think about the human element, the human behavior, right? You want to do something later on in life, but you don't want to pay the tax. So you just end up sitting at home, right? Don't do that.
Yeah.
So create less friction. So you're more likely to pull the trigger and actually do the thing that you want to do. Because that's the point of all of this, right? If you don't pull the trigger and do the thing, okay, you're slightly more optimized, but like you didn't actually do it. So just real quick, like with credit cards and credit card points, we do the whole Southwest thing. It's not life-changing money to do the credit card thing. But when we have an opportunity to fly somewhere and do something fun and we can use points, it's just way easier to pull the trigger because you're not worried about the cost. And so I've tried to help out some of my friends like, hey, you know, and I have this house in Hawaii and I invite my friends. A lot of times they say no, even though they have a free place to stay. They're like, well, the plane tickets are still kind of expensive. I'm like, well, sign up for the Southwest card, get the companion pass, do all this stuff. They're like, no, we'll just pay cash. It's fine. We can say you're, but then when it's time to pull the trigger, people, they just can't do it. And so it's like, get the credit card, get the points. So then when the time comes, you just have way less friction and then you can actually pull the trigger and do the thing.
Good advice.
Yep.
Speaking of Kauai,
yes.
You want to spend more time there.
Yes. So I would say going forward, it's super fun to go there in the summer. So I teach college, but Colorado is awesome in the summer. And it's like, you know, we're doing this thing. So it would be nice if we could design our life to where maybe we're spending a little bit more time in Kauai in the wintertime and then more time in Colorado in the summer. And I kind of feel like that would be the best of both worlds. So that's what I'm kind of working on. And there's like a few different ways I could pull it off. But I mean, it's a difficult problem to have. But if I'm really trying to optimize, that's something, you know, that I'm working on. So yeah.
Would you miss the snowboarding? You could do both, really. It's a long season, right?
Yeah, it's a long season in Colorado, so you can kind of do both. And I don't want to get too fancy, but there's, yeah, I don't know. We could also go to other places in the summertime, to other continents. Like,
yeah,
you know, I got friends that'll go to Australia or actually I got a buddy that in where I live, he's from Australia. Yeah. So there's other ways. So I'll figure it out. But I do want to spend more time in the winter in Hawaii and more time in Colorado in the summer, because the summers are so awesome here. And so I kind of feel like I'm missing out a little bit on some stuff that happens in my own backyard.
Yeah.
So,
and finally, this is an exciting one. Buying 10 plus acres in Alma.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with that?
So I've been looking at mountain properties for a couple of years. I actually did have 10 acres under contract. So it's like about 20 minutes south of Breckenridge. I love to snowboard. I don't love the drive. And when I was younger, I really didn't mind the drive, but I'm 45 now, and it is getting to the point where I was like, it kind of would be nice to kind of have a spot.
Yeah.
And for this though, I kind of feel like I'm at the point where it's probably less investment and probably more personal choice. So the numbers on it might not be great, but that's okay, because I think we're at the point now where like, we don't have to do it as an investment. We probably do it, you know, rent it out part of the time so we don't go broke. But I really want to do some sort of like a X Games type of compound. I am 45. I'm not that young, but you know, some sort of get me outside. I want to do like a mountain biking trail, like maybe a pump track, do like a sledding hill for the kids, you know, snowboard park with a few jumps. And Alma is the highest town in the entire United States. So downtown sits at 10,600 feet.
Oh, really? So it's a little higher than Leadville,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite towns. Yeah.
Yeah. So Leadville, I think, is the highest city or incorporated city.
Yeah.
And then it's just another classification for Alma. And so I've been looking at some properties that are like 11,000 feet. And man, the snow lives forever there. So you could make a super nice like little snowboard park with some small jumps. And that thing will probably go to like June or July.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, people around here would love it. Like Carl hates the heat. I hate the heat. Like we went up to Breckenridge a couple times in the last few years here, and just it's nice to get out of the heat, get up in the mountains.
Yes, I've kind of been going through the same thing. And I lived in Breck for a winter. The other thing that's awesome, not so much in Breckenridge because I live outside of Breckenridge, but in the mornings, like in the winter, it's so quiet. And it's like one of the most incredible experiences I think I've had. Kauai sunsets and then Breckenridge mornings. Like when it's cold, like -5, but it's crisp and you can have like a cup of coffee and it's so quiet, like the animals aren't even out yet. Until you experience something like that, you probably don't realize, because there's just so much noise in our society. There's just like noise all the way around. And honestly, that's part of the reason why Alma is a little bit more attractive for me than actual Breck, because Breck can actually be kind of loud. When I lived in Breck, it was actually way above. It was Breckenridge proper, but it was these townhouses that were like way out of town, like way above town. And so part of the plan is I'd really like to have a spot that's quiet. You know, acreage, you don't really hear your neighbors. And I think it's also an opportunity just to really get centered and like think, and then, you know, live the life that you want to live. But it's not just for pure recreation. But I think for that type of project, it's a big part of it is, I think, like personal growth. I think I would have some really good thoughts up there and really zero in on whatever I'm trying to do. So that's part of the draw.
We're wrapping up, Adam, but I want to give you a minute if you want to, you know, say something to the listeners, to the viewers out there, if they want to follow in your footsteps or anything like that.
Yeah. So hopefully this is inspirational for people. This is kind of the point. I actually do this every day. My audience is different. They're 18-year-old kids. I teach college. So at the very end of the semester, I give a very similar message. You know, personality is mostly genetic. People are born with different traits. They're motivated by different things. Try to find your own path. Try to find the thing that makes you tick. Try to find the thing that you're passionate about. And when you're doing the things that you really want to do and you believe in, you know, it's just very, very difficult to lose in that sort of situation. And what happens is, though, we're social creatures, we're influenced by others, and you'll have very well-intentioned people trying to help you out. They mean well, but their path might but not be your path. So you kind of have the confidence to be like, that's working for you and that's awesome, but that's not my path. And I kind of feel like if you really want to live your best life, what I'm trying to do is I pick out people that are like maybe 5, 10, 15 years older than me, and then they're doing the things that I want to do. And so I seek them out and then I ask them like, hey, like, what's your deal? What are you doing? And then I just try to copy them. And the idea is if you copy people that are doing the things that you want to do, that's just going to happen. That's just the natural path. But then if you copy people that are doing these other things that is not your path, then you're gonna go in the path that you're not supposed to go. So copy people that are doing the things that you want to do. And then in a few years, you're going to be doing them too.
Adam, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining me. Now, you don't have a place for folks to follow you exactly.
Nope.
But you're going to hang out in the Facebook group a little bit.
Yep.
People can find that. You could join. I'll let you in. I have to approve your request. I have to approve yours too,
yes,
Adam.
Yes.
But it's over at milehighfi.com/Facebook. And I think there's good discussion going in there. Carl was kind of managing that.
Okay.
But I hop in there occasionally when I remember to. I should formalize that a little bit. But you'll be in the Facebook group a little
bit. Yes, I'll join the Facebook group. And I'm really excited to be part of this tribe. You know, I kind of been searching for my group and I'm stoked to be here. And so I'll join and hopefully we can have more interactions and, you know, hopefully we can learn from one another and help each other out.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number 1, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number 2, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number 3, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. So we just had pizza at the Mr. Money Mustache HQ. Pete wasn't there, but there were a bunch of people having pizza. And just curious, like, what did you think of the vibe there and everything?
I could feel the aura. I could feel the Mr. Money Mustache aura. It was there. It was very good pizza. Haven't had it. What was it called? Where was it from?
Urban Fields.
I've had Cosmo's pizza. Have you had Cosmo's, the really big ones?
I don't know. It sounds familiar, but
They're like this.
What town are they?
I don't know. They're all around the Front Range. But if you drive a compact car, you might not actually qualify to deliver for them. So you might actually need a flatbed truck.
You need something big.
Yeah, yeah. But no, very good pizza. Beautiful day. Love this time of year. Sunshine, nice and cool. The outside space was relaxing with the trees and the fall colors. And a place where you could probably get some really good work done in like a kind of a relaxed environment.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, I mentioned to you, not a lot of people work in there. Today's a Friday, so a lot of people do take a Friday off. But I think like most times when I've gone in, maybe there's 2 people working, like 2 mm-hmm. or 3, and sometimes 0. Like I've gone in and it seems like completely deserted. So you really could get a lot done. Other times, I think maybe if people coordinate, there is a little bit more of a crowd. But yeah, apparently they've been doing the Pizza Fridays for a couple of months now. And today was the first time that I checked it out. Thing is, I love pizza. In fact, I made these stickers. It says, yes, pizza is my love language. And I passed those out. And it would just be like a unhealthy thing to do every Friday.
Yes. And we're recording this on November 1st. And so I had a little over a pound of candy, chocolate, Milky Way, Snickers. And the best thing to follow that up the next day is just go right into pizza.
Pizza. Yeah. We were wise and didn't get into the beers. So there was beer there, and I was like, I almost got one, and then I was like, I'm better off if I just get more pizza.
Good move. Good move.
Yeah, so that worked out well. The alternative, and I was like, yeah, maybe we could do a happy hour, but there's actually been a couple parties. There was one last weekend. There's one this like following weekend. Mm-hmm. So I was like, people may not be ready to do it every single week. So anyway, I was like, all right, we'll figure something out. We'll get over to HQ. But I think that worked out well. Like I don't know if you know this, but I was like trying to make sure people showed up today. So I was like, hey, it can't just be like one pizza and three of us. So about a dozen.
There's nothing worse than like planning a party and having nobody show up. Like that's just, and you know, just based on random statistics, that's going to happen to somebody, even if you're the best person ever. And so I just feel so bad for someone and they plan something. It's like, oh, my kids got sick. And then this happened and that happened. You plan a party and like 25 people are supposed to be there and like nobody shows up. It's like, I'm a social psychologist. That's social rejection. It's like the worst feeling in the world. So it totally makes sense to me.
Yeah. So it worked out fine, yep. And I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, I had a great time.